Hello, and welcome to Partners in Diplomacy, a podcast series exploring the service, sacrifice, and adventure of life as a Foreign Service family member. I'm your host, Bonnie Miller. Today is May 21st, 2021, and we're joined by Lauren McKinnon-Steed from Guangzhou, China, who will tell us about her many tours accompanying her FSO husband, Matt, and some interesting organizations that she has founded to help global nomads and third culture kids. Welcome, Lauren. We're so glad to have you here to share your experiences and knowledge.
Hi, Bonnie. I'm really glad to be here, too.
So let's start with your childhood. You were born in 1978 in Ohio, but moved soon after to California. Tell us about your family and what it was like growing up in the 80s in California.
When we arrived in California, I think it was still kind of old California in a way. There was, you know, orange trees in Orange County, and there were golden hills full of flowers. Today, it's a place full of houses and water droughts and that kind of thing. So for me, it was a time kind of that I look back on almost, I think, like Laura Ingalls Wilder looked back on her childhood, you know, a transitional time, a nostalgia. But my memories are at a house on the edge of kind of those golden hills. And I spent a lot of time wandering around, chasing rattlesnakes and doing kind of dangerous things that kids would do. Like I said, a nostalgic, idyllic memory of what my childhood was like.
You have a very eclectic educational background, including a PhD in ethics and social theory. Can you tell us a little bit about your studies?
So I like to tell people that I came to study ethics partly because it was a degree field that touched on everything. I was able to study healthcare and engineering and politics and every other kind of field by doing ethics. But at the same time, it was also very motivating to me as far as understanding like why people make decisions, what kind of decisions we should make. I studied at a variety of schools that were vastly different. So I came from a very traditional Catholic undergraduate university and ended up eventually at a very non-traditional graduate school that was kind of on the borders of UC Berkeley. And I came to ethics thinking that for me, it was a study of a variety of fields. I could use this question of why do we do things and what should we be doing? And I ended up working with students who were in all of these fields. But my own focus kind of ended up being in issues of migration and political representation and that kind of thing, which has been great as far as being a Foreign Service spouse. I really focus instead on that idea of why are we doing things and what should we do next in kind of a more practical way.
So how did you meet your husband, Matthew, and when did you get married?
So we're not the first people I know who got together on an internet dating site, but it was pretty new at the time. Today, of course, everybody meets on the internet, and it's the number one way to get matchmaked. But we met in the California Bay Area, and we lived on opposite sides of the San Francisco Bay, so we had to cross the bridges every time we wanted to go on a date. But both of us at the time were applying to be Foreign Service officers. I'm really glad that he's the one that got pulled off the bid list and not me, because I've really ended up liking the EFM life I've led. But it made it really easy to say yes to everything because we already had that interest in common.
So you both wanted to be in the Foreign Service life, but it worked for you to be an eligible family member, as they say, an EFM, and for him to be the officers. So did you weigh in on which postings you would go to, which countries that he would serve in?
So we ended up at DACA for our first post. And we had a list of something like 110, maybe, posts that we could choose from. And we're going through and sitting in the center at FSI where you can research the options for posts and trying to read what was available online at the time, find expat sites in various countries and learn about the options for entertainment or travel. Also, going with just gut feeling. And I had a favorite kind of indie band that I listened to at the time. And they had a song that was romantic about a missionary who'd gone to DACA. And I was like, I really like that song. I sing to it all the time. Let's put DACA on the list. That's the first post we ended up going to. So all that other research was pointless.
So it had to be karma that brought you to Bangladesh. And what was it like when you actually lived there?
It was extremely hot, kind of what your stereotype is of life in South Asia. Muggy. Throughout my time there, there was this kind of tension between traffic, because there's a lot of traffic there, and just so much interesting culture. I had these big plans of working at the university or whatever, but it was significantly far enough away that there was no way I could get there in traffic. But we were able to get to the airport pretty easily, so we could travel in the region. We met a lot of people there, both foreign service people, but also local staff and local contacts, who ended up becoming our friends. I feel like for everybody, your first post kind of sets the tone for the rest of your foreign service career. It defines how you'll bid in the future. And we say, how does that compare to what life is like in Dhaka? Will the community be that really strong, makes a plan every weekend kind of community that we had there? Will we have the traffic that we suffered through while we were there? Just all those kinds of questions. Almost always the comparison is, what was life like in Dhaka versus what will it be like in the future?
And did you work there in the embassy or on the local economy or remotely when you lived there for those 2 years?
All three of those things, actually. So I brought with me remote teaching at a university that I was teaching at in the U.S., but I found it was not very fulfilling. Remote teaching for philosophy and ethics and that kind of thing tends to be a lot more sterile than it is in the classroom. I started substitute teaching at the high school, but I also took a job in the embassy eventually as their English language specialist for USAID, and I taught language improvement classes for the local staff. Many of them spoke like a variant of British English, so we had to work on making it so that their writing was approachable for an American audience. I got to edit their video transcripts and work on their four-year development plan report. So there was just a lot of variety in the teaching and editing work I got to do with that. It was a great job.
And maybe that laid the groundwork for future jobs, too. The skills that you learned and also getting to know the inside of the embassy and also working with the locals.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons it was really an excellent job, because a lot of my work was with the local staff, which I wasn't expecting, really, to have the opportunity to work with people in country who were from the country.
So that worked out well for you. And then for your second posting, you went to Seoul, Korea, from 2012 to 2015. Did you work in Korea or remotely? What was life like there?
We arrived to Korea in the exact opposite kind of weather that we had arrived to Dhaka. That night, it was frigid, and that also kind of set the tone for what life would be like in Korea. I had an infant who was only a few months old, and I was immediately looking for work. I started out applying for jobs at the embassy. The hiring timeline was pretty long at the time. At the same time, they had this really excellent employee association grant program there. In Seoul, EFM's employees could apply for grants from the employee association to provide classes or other community building activities for the community. So I applied for a grant and was able to start running a daytime art class for small children who weren't in school yet. So we did everything from dipping babies in paint and rolling them on paper to setting up bounce houses full of cotton balls and jumping around until there was enough static that the cotton balls stuck to everybody. It was just all sorts of crazy fun activities with the kids of the community while I was waiting to find out if I would be able to have a job. I also started a teaching credential program, so I was looking online with the U.S. trying to get my teaching credential. And then eventually I started working as a rover in the embassy, which is one of those jobs that is often made fun of, but provided me with the opportunity to go to, again, every single office and do every single job almost at the embassy, which was great fun.
So you really showed your versatility.
Being a rover really provided me with a lot of opportunity to learn how the embassy worked. I did everything in that job, from doing the cost of living survey, in which I went to various shops and priced out the cost of a can of corn and the cost of a white blouse in order to compare it to prices back in the US. I worked in the security office making badges and approving visitor access requests for admission to the embassy. I worked in the front office, which is the ambassador's office, as an assistant to the deputy chief of mission, and that was for several months, so I really got to know what life was like in the more high-pressure environments. I spent a little bit of time examining mail for potential problems, illegal substances or whatever might have been dropped off. I also spent some time doing probably the least exciting part of a rover, which was watching people vacuum, because you have to always make sure that anybody who's coming in as a contractor is watched carefully. So I did spend several days just watching people vacuum.
But that was a security function. That wasn't just watching people vacuum. You were providing a security function that enabled people to work there and enabled the embassy to stay safe.
Yes, and it was partly because everybody at that time was doing that same job. We'd had a water main break or something inside, and even the officers in the front office were watching vacuuming.
So where and when were your children born? And also, how have they adjusted to being third culture kids?
My first daughter was born when we were living in Dhaka. We decided that if we were going to have to go back to the U.S. on a medical evacuation, which is true for Dhaka, that we would go to a place that had wonderful weather, even in February. So we went to Clearwater, Florida, and rented a house on the beach. And I spent those last 6 weeks of being pregnant walking on the beach every morning and enjoying that kind of foggy, wonderful winter Florida weather. My second daughter was born in the exact opposite situation. We were in Korea at the time. We had her at the U.S. Army Hospital at Yongsan in Korea, which I think at the time I thought was the best plan, but I heard later that Korean hospitals are actually brilliant. So if you go in to have your baby at a regular Korean hospital, you can get your nails done and they give you a massage. But if you can imagine what an army hospital birth would be like, if you could stereotype that as much as possible, that's exactly what it was like. They were dressed in army uniforms and they gave me commands. It was very, very military. So I forgot to answer your question about how my kids have adjusted. I don't think my kids know anything else other than being TCKs. It was very hard for them when we went back to the U.S. for a year to adjust to trying to be domestic students, because they were coming from Africa, and some of the other kids thought that they were telling stories, that they were lying. That experience was a much harder transition than it is for them to move from one country to another, where other people are also TCKs. But they're still young. I think when they get to high school and they're a little more self-reflective about it, they might be happy or they might be sad about this itinerant lifestyle that we've chosen. But at least for now, it's what they know. This is normal for them. And they don't even think that it's weird at all.
So that is the culture of the third culture kids. They move from one country to another, and it's like, where are we going next? What a lot of families don't think about, because they're coming back to their home country, is the whole reentry process. And coming back to America, where the parents usually grew up, unless it was a case of a foreign-born spouse, of which we have many, but the children didn't remember being in America. So that really is a challenge for a lot of kids, and it sounds like it was for yours too.
Yes, definitely. Going back to our home country and going back to even a very diverse international kind of elementary school was very difficult. It was just bigger. The students had all been together before they knew each other. It was a difficult time for them.
So you came back to Washington. Is that where you started Nomad Educational Services?
Yes, I did start Nomad Educational Services around that time when I was back in D.C. But it's just me. The organization is me. I had come back to D.C. and was working at a high school and an elementary school for a while. But at the same time, I was working afternoons and evenings at a agency that did high school tutoring and high school advising for college. And while I was there, there were a lot of parents who were very, very stressed out about their children's future. So stressed out, it sounded like they were equating their children's future college choices with their own success in life. And I think it forced them into a lot of behaviors with their children that were not very helpful for their children's actual confidence and success. And so I said, you know, this is a problem that I don't just see in Northern Virginia, but also something that I can do elsewhere. And I was already doing it a little bit in Dhaka and in Seoul, several Foreign Service officers and EFMs had come to me and said, hey, I know you have a PhD. You must have some skill with college. Can you help me read my application and prepare for grad school applications and that kind of thing? So I was doing it and I had been considering it for a while, but I was very nervous about the idea of starting a business. It just seems so impossible. There's so much involved in a business that I wasn't ready. But after that experience at the agency and knowing that we were moving on to Rwanda for our next post, it was just a karmic moment, kind of just the exact perfect time for me to say, you know what? There's actually not as much holding me back from trying this out as there would be for someone who doesn't have the opportunities the Foreign Service presents. There's a lot of freedoms that I get as the spouse of a Foreign Service officer that I wouldn't maybe have if I was working full-time in the US and couldn't imagine a transition like that. I'm used to transitions already. Let's go for it. So I actually applied for a professional development fellowship, which is a benefit offered to spouses in the Foreign Service in order to do some retraining. I did some retraining as a college counselor, connected that with my history working with other people on their applications, connected it with my history helping high school students transition into college, which was one of the things I did as a professor, and then started Nomad as an advising program, mostly for expat students who are coming to school in the US or looking for university in Europe or Australia or some other English-speaking area. As Nomad, I offer this kind of counseling program, but I also run webinars and workshops so expat parents can learn what the reality is of college admissions now and not just remember what it was like for themselves and not realize that it's changed a lot maybe since they went to school.
That's really interesting on a couple of levels. So you give them facts and you tell them what to expect and you guide them through the process. You also help with the psychological component, which is kind of allaying their anxieties about the unknown, especially if they've been overseas for a long time, especially first-time parents with high school seniors. And you're right, it's not like it was 25, 30 years before when they were applying to colleges and being in college. Also, you just mentioned something that I did not know about, and maybe our listeners don't either, and that was a grant of how you got into this business. So tell us about that grant, what it's called, and what it does.
So the Professional Development Fellowship, or PDF, is a grant offered once a year to spouses in the Foreign Service. And you can apply for a certain amount of money that will allow you to go back and either take college courses in a field that you're in or that you would like to go in order to uptrain yourself, to use kind of businessy language, to upscale. And then many of the people who graduate from that fellowship, which is funded for a year, go on to found their own businesses or start projects that help them be more portable in their career. So it was just a really great opportunity, and I encourage everybody who has the opportunity to try and apply and take it.
That is really a huge step forward. So let's move on. You moved to Kigali, Rwanda in 2017, and what was your life like there in that African country?
That was the best post so far. I had the most opportunities. I had the most happiness. Everything from great weather to great people. When I headed toward Kigali, we were in the middle of the global EFM hiring freeze. In other words, spouses were not able to take jobs at embassies, or embassies were not able to hire spouses at embassies for several months. I was also generating that idea of Nomad Educational Services. It hadn't come out fully yet. So this is when I applied for the PDF. At the same time, I was researching, you know, what the options were in Rwanda for organizations or jobs on the ground for expats. When I got there, other people were like, hey, I've got somebody that I think you will work well with. And multiple people within hours of each other had gotten my name or heard my name or passed on my name. And so I was starting to get emails from people related to this organization or about the organization. And I ended up working with Bridge to Rwanda. It's an American NGO that helps high-achieving, low-income students in East Africa prepare for, apply to, and attend university in the United States. I worked there teaching SAT and ACT test prep teaching transitional programs to help students learn what American university life is like. Also, what is expected of them as a university student that might be different from the educational model in East Africa. Also, we had kind of a blend of students from stable communities and students from refugee communities. So there was a lot of development and personal work about how big of a transition this will be for them to go from refugee camp to middle class or upper class university in the United States and just overwhelming amounts of food and freedom. It was a wonderful place to work. The people that I worked with there are significantly influential in what the work I do now and in my own motivation to help both my expat clients with Nomad, but also all students, you know, prepare for university. It was just a glorious time. We also sent our kids to the non-traditional elementary school, so not the school that everybody else had sent their kids to. So our social circle was vastly expanded there from the American bubble to the broader expat bubble in a way that we hadn't at our previous posts. So I have additionally friends in the NGO industry throughout Africa and throughout the world now that I met that were, you know, my kids' parents' friends, essentially.
That's really interesting because I always hark back to saying one man's or one woman's heaven is another one's hell. And some people would have maybe said to you, you're going to Rwanda? Didn't they just have a genocide there? Then isn't that in the middle of Africa? And yet you found so many interesting opportunities. And it sounds like with Bridge to Rwanda, you are kind of like a cultural coach for not only Africans, not only poor people, but refugees who just had no idea what it would be like in America and going to school with Americans who also had no idea what it would be like going to school with Africans. So you really did provide that bridge. So since 2020, last year, you've been living in Guangzhou, China, a whole departure from your previous life. And as if you weren't busy enough with your job at Nomad and your diplomatic life and raising your two kids, you decided to start Available Worldwide with your friend Stephanie Anderson, who is posted in Berlin. So tell us about the history and the goals of this project, and also what does it mean to be available worldwide?
Late in 2020, there was a holiday-themed EFM business fair in which other spouse-owned small businesses sold products. So I participated in it, and afterwards we had a debriefing of how the event had gone and what people wanted to do next. And a kind of a side comment that somebody made in that conversation was, I wish we had some opportunity for our spouse businesses to be introduced to the world. And that kind of stuck with me, but it grew in my mind, and I just thought about it for a really long time. And when January came around and everybody else is making New Year's resolutions and thinking about how they're going to change themselves, and I said to myself, I think my goal for this year is that I want other EFMs, other spouses, to feel like they are successful, that they are able to take their opportunities and run with it and make interesting lives, even though their life isn't measured in the same way that maybe their domestic peers' lives are measured. And so I did a couple different things this year as part of that. One of them is start the Available Worldwide podcast. I called up Stephanie, and she was obviously hesitant at the first conversation because, like me, she's overextended and involved in too many projects. And I said, I think that you and I together would be an awesome duo to start a podcast about what EFMs are doing right now in order to tell their stories, show off their skills, to create their own success. So we talk about it in terms of the superpowers of an EFM, that discovery that suddenly you are a bit of a hero, even if you doubt your own story sometimes along the way. So we mostly interview business owners or people who are kind of in that same capacity, like a strong volunteer or something. And we've interviewed people who run all sorts of businesses. We have a real estate investor, a mental health therapist, speech therapist, an occupational therapist. There's a lot of therapists in the Foreign Service, apparently. We have people who do consulting with schools, who do consulting with large industry. We have a piano teacher who teaches remotely and in person. Lots of different kinds of jobs that they've taken on and found that they're both portable or that they're really serving a need in the community around them. So we call it available worldwide because there's a requirement for Foreign Service officers to have worldwide availability when they're hired, which means that they can serve at any country that the department needs them to be in. So for us, available worldwide is a little bit of a play on that. We have to have that same kind of worldwide availability to get anywhere. But also, it makes us sound a little bit like a product, because products are available worldwide. You buy something on TV and it's like, ah, this is available worldwide! And so we are having to be that exciting, creative moment everywhere we go. We have to start new and re-establish ourselves at every new post in a way that maybe our spouses don't. A play on worldwide availability and a play on that sense that we are moving and new everywhere we go.
That's really interesting about reinventing yourself at every post, because the Foreign Service officer, him or herself, has a linear career where they climb up the ladder and they go post to post, and it makes sense. And they get a lot of glory, especially as they get into mid-levels and senior level. A lot of respect goes with the position. So the family member has to figure out, now that I'm at X post, what am I going to do? And it's interesting that you chose podcast as a medium, because I had never known very much about podcasts till I did my first one a year ago, and now I'm a podcast host. So I guess that is the medium for you and for us. And also, I like the way that you highlight the empowering stories of family members who go to a different post and maybe do something completely different and maybe reinvent themselves and maybe provide a service for the embassy community or the expat community or the local community in using their skills. So one of the last questions, has your Foreign Service experience given you any opportunities, either personal or professional, that you wouldn't have enjoyed if you had stayed in the U.S. for your whole life?
The trajectory of my career before we started the Foreign Service was to become an academic, to work at a university. The Foreign Service has provided me with, I think, a little bit of courage, because that career path of an academic is really clearly defined. You work through tenure and become a full professor.
And you publish or perish.
You publish all the time. So much publishing. And that for me wasn't the joy of being an academic. The joy of being an academic was working with students. And so there was always that tension, even at the time when I was doing it more full time, of whether this was the career I really wanted, because I wanted to teach. I didn't want to publish. I didn't want to write boring essays about what other people had written boring essays about. So when we got to the Foreign Service and the first couple tours, it felt a little bit difficult to reinvent myself. And because my spouse's career is stable, even though we move and there's a lot of changes and there's sudden upsets or whatever, relatively stable. So I don't feel like I am threatening my family's existence by trying something new. I was able to literally try new things constantly. I tried so many different jobs. I tried so many different, volunteer opportunities before I found the ones that really worked for me. And, you know, it ended up being the same ones that I was interested in before, but able to do it in a portable kind of serving my community kind of way. So I think that's the biggest thing that it's provided for me, is that like kind of courage. Oh, well, what's going to happen if I don't try? I'll just be stuck afraid that I could have done something. But instead I did try. And I've been happy with it.
And also successful, and also providing very much needed services for others who are coming to you for advice, and also others who are participating in your podcast as well. So do you have any final thoughts, lessons learned, words of wisdom, or advice for spouses whose partners are considering a career in the Foreign Service? And what would be realistic expectations of a career in the Foreign Service for a spouse?
I think my advice for spouses would largely be that you're going to have to be ready to define yourself differently than the people you know now define themselves. I defined myself previously as an academic. I saw success as financial. I saw success as a progression through a career, a clearly defined career that other people took. And it's only now, in this mid-level part of our Foreign Service life, that I'm seeing that success isn't about making more money this year than I made last year. That success isn't about having a fancier title this year than I did last year. That success is about, for me at least, having connections with the people I work for. And I've talked to a lot of other spouses, a lot of other business owners, a lot of other people who are kind of on the same journey as me. And their successes are defined differently, but they had to take that and define it themselves. So you just have to be ready to find another way to define what you think of as success, or what you think of as improving yourself. Otherwise, you're going to be very dissatisfied.
Lauren, thank you so much for sharing your stories about your Foreign Service life with your husband and the organizations you've founded that help Foreign Service families and others living overseas. You are emblematic of a versatile and creative Foreign Service partner who has created opportunities and continued your career while serving abroad with your husband. Thank you for listening. If you are curious to learn more about the lives of Foreign Service family members, subscribe and listen to additional episodes in our Partners in Diplomacy series. To learn more about the experiences of America's diplomats and diplomacy, visit our website at adst.org or check us out on Twitter and Facebook. The Partners in Diplomacy podcast is funded by the Una Chapman Cox Foundation. Our theme music is We Are One by Scott Holmes. Our assistant producer is Sumaya Ishrat. Our producers are James Fowler and Mark Rincon. Our audio engineering and post-production are provided by James Fowler and Post Productions. My name is Bonnie Miller. Until next time.